be fine, and let me be in Carolina in the morning.
The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Joe Simpson for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to a special Down East edition of Triangle Yesteryear. On this program, you'll hear reminiscences of life in earlier times around North Carolina. On today's special show, I'll be reading excerpts from An Outer Banks Reader, selected and edited by David Stick. Hatteras Highway by Bill Sharp, 1952. Back in 1936, a bewildered motorist, struggling through the sandy ruts of the Outer Banks, stopped on top of the Great Flat near Pea Island, where a WPA worker was building sand fences. He wanted to know which road to take to Hatteras. "Take Road 108," he was told. A half hour later, after following one auto track in the sand after another, he had circled back and approached the same man. "Which road did you tell me to take to Hatteras?" he asked. The boy wearily pointed to the maze of ruts. "Take 108. There's 108 roads to Hatteras." Morris Burris of Hatteras told it mirthfully. It's a lot funnier to a motorist today than it was to a badgered and laughed at beach traveler of 1936. There'll be a road all the way to Hatteras soon, and it isn't any joke. It's a real paved highway, the solution of one of North Carolina's most unusual engineering problems. To most people, native and traveler, who for years have groped their way along old 108, the new highway is a success story. But to others, the highway not only is not a joke, it is a grim door slammed upon another fragment of the vanishing frontier. The slow ferry landed you on the south side of Oregon Inlet, and you were upon a finger of sand which pointed in a general southeasterly direction. As you headed south, the surf broke upon a lonely beach on your left, and on your right, Pamlico Sound swiftly widened into the vast inland sea which it is, until the continental mainland was pushed far to the west, and you rode a tightrope of sand to the ends of the earth. There was a choice of routes. At low tide, most people rode the wash, which is the business of driving your car with the left wheels almost, but not quite, in the ocean. And if there were no wind-made camelback humps, and if the sand was hard and firm, as it usually was, this was a fine speedway. Or you took the inside, a road composed of the most recent set of ruts made by those who preceded you. It was a road by custom only. It had neither right-of-way nor maintenance. An old driving rule on the Outer Banks is to follow the most auto tracks, no matter where they lead. It's a good rule today, and will be a good rule until the last stretch of pavement on the new highway is completed. Those first 20 miles of driving from the ferry had a lot to do with determining whether you were suited for the Outer Banks or not. No matter where you went, the dull roar of the surf always was in your ears. Except for Pea Island Coast Guard Station, until recently manned by the only all-Negro lifeguard crew in America, there was not a habitation in that first 20 miles. There are no rural people on the banks. Simple and inconvenient as life is on the island, it is no place for hermits, and people live in tight little villages, seven of them, all located on the Sound or the west side. It's not possible on the banks to get very far away from the ocean, but the villagers are as far from it as geography permits. For the most part, they spent their lives on that side, so as you drove down the banks, you had an ocean and a beach all to yourself. It is a beautiful beach, highly exposed and disturbing under the threat of a hurricane, because it offers no hope of shelter, but benign on a sunny day and under a moderate wind. Your car would throw up an almost continual cloud of shorebirds, an astonishing variety, bird fans say, in front of you. The remnants of old wrecks protruded from the beach. The sands covered and uncovered them at the will of the winds. At the Coast Guard stations, which once were more numerous than they are now, you could talk to the men who saw these crafts come ashore. In the records you could read which of your companions were the heroes of those disasters, and in some instances you would see the medals and citations given by our own and foreign governments to these sturdy surfmen, living out their careers in these lonely posts. For every mile there is a wreck, for every wreck a deed of heroism, and for every deed a dozen enchanting stories. If you took the inside, you would encounter the villages of Rodanthe, Waves, Salvo, Avon, and Buxton, before reaching the Cape itself. If you traveled the beach, you would never know that these communities were just a little way to your right. At the Cape, or the Point, as it's called there, the Outer Banks continue stubbornly out into the Atlantic, but now under water, and now forming Diamond Shoals, the greatest area of quicksand in the world. Over these shoals, the water seethes and hisses in bad water, throwing spray high in the air. The shoals comprise the most dangerous navigational hazard of the American seaboard, and it's said that only one vessel ever to strike on them ever came off alive, and she drifted off mysteriously after her crew had taken to their boats. At the Cape, the shoreline turns almost due west to be terminated by Hatteras Inlet. Also west of the Cape, the land rises to an altitude of 90 feet, and here is Cape Woods, or Trent, a thick growth of pines, myrtle, yaupon. In this forest is the village of Buxton, a place of perhaps 500 people. Even in a country which, to its natives, is without compare, Buxton is exalted. It contains many retired people, principally those who have seen service in the Coast Guard or some other branch of government service. The island as a whole has a large proportion of pensioners. It's only a few miles from here to your journey's end, the village of Hatteras itself. On this island are perhaps 2,000 persons. It would be a mistake to call them lotus eaters, for this is largely a barren island, and the elements are as often stern and forbidding as they are pleasant. With the exception of Trent Woods, Hatteras is as exposed as the deck of a ship uneasily anchored in an uneasy sea. Although a sand fixation project of the 1930s has encouraged growth of grass, shrubs, and some scrubby pines north of Buxton, the island's geography is still in a state of flux. But those who have lived on Hatteras like it. For many others, it has been a secret retreat from the distractions of the mainland. If the island was neglected so long by road builders, it was always overlooked by less beneficent improvements. It lacks a drugstore, and for a long time had no doctor, but it also had no neon signs, jukeboxes, or a jail. Until a couple of years ago, the nearest law was at Manteo, but there was less crime and disorder in the seven island villages in a year than there was in Manteo and Nag's Head on a lusty weekend. The only telephone was in the Coast Guard service. There were no luncheon clubs, and consequently, no luncheon club speakers, and political orators found the arduous trip not worth taking. There were no bridge clubs, mayors, city councilmen, health officers, traffic congestion, or traffic lights. There was a great lack of hurry and bustle. There aren't many places to go on the island, and most natives have been to them already. There are few excuses for scheming around to make money, because there's little of it to be made. The difference between the richest man on the island and the poorest man is slighter than in any community we know. You don't keep up with the Joneses, because there are no Joneses to keep up with, either literally or metaphorically. But there is no squalor on the banks. If there is, it doesn't appear to be poverty in this environment. Sport fishing is good in this territory, and also waterfowl hunting, and it is the excuse most people use to go there, though you can swim on a good beach. Beyond that, you have to improvise your own recreation. The weather, in spite of the well-founded slanders heard about it, is good on the whole. It's about 12 degrees warmer in winter and cooler in summer than it is at the closest mainland weather station. Naturally, a highway to such a special place would be kind of special. And the highway being built from Oregon Inlet to the village of Hatteras is one of the most unique ever attempted. This one is being constructed according to specifications laid down by the wind and the sea. Contractors who've punctured mountains and spanned gorges soon learned that damp sand in a nor'easter is more formidable than granite and space. The banks are being conquered with their own sand, which is an ingredient in the asphalt base of the highway. The Ballingers found the sand fine for beachcombers, but lousy for road building. So, liquid asphalt, made by mixing naphtha in it, was substituted for the hot asphalt usually used on roadbeds. When the naphtha evaporated, only the asphalt was left, and the sand was found suitable when used this way. How to elevate the road was a major problem for Ballinger Paving Company of Greenville, the contractors. Experience showed that attempts to defy the elements failed, and so engineers conspired to make the road live in compatibility with the water. Nor'easters sometimes bring high waves in from the ocean. Southwesters flood the area from the other side, the Sound. There were special problems, too. The project may go down in history as the only one in which a barge sank at a point about where the curb would be on a large inland highway. The barge, loaded with trucks, a Caterpillar tractor, and other equipment, sank in about 9 feet of water in December 1947. Using a diver and huge cranes, Ballinger recovered their equipment and marked it down as just another hazard of the contract. The new road has been proceeding in links. The 17.3-mile link between Hatteras and Avon was finished in August 1948. The link between Avon and Rodanthe, 17.8 miles, is almost complete. Work began on the 12.4 miles between Rodanthe and the south shore of Oregon Inlet in January 1952 and is due for completion, quote, sometime before the summer is over. So, here's the way it is. Those who want their Hatteras with comfort and convenience and with all the good things a highway can bring will have to wait a little while. Those who want to see a simpler, more rugged Hatteras that they'll never see again had best get going fast. Cap'n Ban and the Infernal Engine. From Ben Dixon McNeil's 1958 book, The Hatterasman. Evil came. It came in a box, together with a book, which those of his crew who confessed an ability to read said were instructions for use and operation. The box contained what was called a naphtha engine, and the papers which came with it said that the engine was to be installed in such and such a boat, and, after the directed tests were had, a full report was to be submitted. In writing, of course. Bannister Midget was filled with disgust and dismay. He had the islanders' inherited distrust of steam, though he had not long been born when the Horn of Gabriel sounded first above the Sounds. But he had seen enough of steamboats during that war, which left him illiterate, to last him a lifetime. He remembered with gleeful chortling that day when the Yankees gave out of steam, and a lot of Confederates, with sailboats, surrounded the steamless craft and took every man jack of the crew prisoner, and maybe took them off down the Sound somewhere and drowned them, like they should have done. It is not unlikely that if Bannister Midget had had only the orders from afar off, from Washington itself, to contend with, he would have, as was generally his custom, ignored the box altogether, and, at a suitable time, dumped it into the ocean. But there was his crew's curiosity about what was in the box, and what was in the accompanying book. Every day among themselves, and just within his hearing, they discussed the engine and the book, and they wondered what it would do if they installed it in a skiff, like the book said, and started her up. When these tactics got them nowhere, and the box and its baleful content just stood there, they shifted into attack. They began to wonder, privately and among themselves, of course, whether Captain Ban was afraid of it. Bannister Midget had, it is remembered, uncommonly keen hearing, and his ears were, even in the Leslie picture, if indeed it is he, astonishingly big. They protruded widely beyond the reach of his impressive black whiskers. There came a day when this passive resistance and this not wholly passive insistence could stand no more. Bannister Midget bellowed very loudly and blasphemously, and the crew took up the box, the book, and the skiff, and they went down to the Sound shore. They put down the skiff with its stern protruding into shallow water. The keeper was a handy man with tools, and he had directed the building of the station house, and the installation of the propeller, or wheel, was no problem. Bannister Midget worked alone, and nearby the crew sat with the book. This was one of the very earliest naphtha engines, made in an era in which the word gasoline had not been contrived. It was a very crude engine, gearless and reversible. It had a single cylinder, and the directions in the book were as simple as the mechanism itself. The crew sat on the bank and read out of the book, beginning with instruction 1, and continued down the roster of procedures. It took most of the day, and the only comment Bannister Midget had to make was, "What does it say next?" Toward the middle of the afternoon, the installation had come down to that section, How to Start Naphtha Engine. Foul-smelling fuel was decanted into the opening appointed to receive it, and the engine was, insofar as they could know from reading in the book, ready to be started, when Bannister Midget asked the final and critical question, "What does it say now?" They read to him out of the book. And then the engines started, with such a roar as had not been heard hereabout since the unlethal bombardment at the Battle of Chickamauga, years earlier. Somewhere or other, Bannister Midget must not have been paying full attention to the scholarly members, the reading members, of his crew. The engine started in reverse, and the propeller bit hungrily into the water. Before he had time to consider what was happening, the boat was plumb out of the harbor, plumb out of range of his mentors on the shore. Ahead, 15 or so miles, lay the dimly outlined shore of the mainland, over about Payne's Creek, and the skiff was headed there, stern first. Ashore, the crew ran hither and yon, some wading out into the water as deep as their knees, and all shouting. Their words were shredded by the counter-roar of the godless, implacable engine that was hurling him westward, Payne's Creekward, at a fearful velocity. He was unable to determine what he should do next, or what the book would have recommended. But somehow, the damnable piece of evil had to be silenced, stopped. Even now, 60 years after the ill-starred advent of the naphtha engine, no prudent islander will get wading distance from the shore in a motor-driven boat without an oar handy. There was an oar in the skiff, and Bannister Midget knew the uses of an oar, even new and not yet tried uses. He took up the oar, and, with the butt of it, about half a mile outward bound, he beat the engine into submission. No vestige of it remains, but it is doubtful that even its designer and builder could have ever induced it to run again. The oar survived practically intact, and with it Bannister Midget rowed himself back to the shore. He beached the skiff and spoke briefly to his crew before he strode away toward the station, which he had built and which he commanded 36 years. "Some of you that can write, write them a letter and say that the damned thing is no good for this country, and get the damned thing out of that skiff." Old Christmas by Jan DeBlieu, 1987. Every January on Hatteras Island, a week or so after most families have packed up the duties and indulgences of the holidays, the residents of Rodanthe hold a celebration known as Old Christmas. It's simultaneously a meeting of friends and a curious gathering of people with little in common but their hometown and perhaps their last names. Old Christmas has been observed in Rodanthe on the Saturday closest to Epiphany for at least 100 years. It is said to have had its beginnings in 1752, when England adopted the Gregorian calendar and shortened the calendar year by 11 days. According to legend, the towns of Hatteras Island were not informed of the change until decades later, and then they refused to abide by it. Whether or not the legend is true, a tradition has evolved whereby the townspeople of Rodanthe spend Christmas Day with relatives in Waves, Salvo, or southern parts of the island, then throw a party in the Rodanthe Community Center to observe the holiday a second time. The celebration is planned for local families, and although tourists are welcomed, they seldom grasp the significance of the event. Moreover, many tourists are reluctant to attend, for Old Christmas has the reputation of being a drunken brawl. It once was customary for the men of Hatteras Island to settle their grudges against each other once a year with a fist fight after dinner on Old Christmas. The custom seldom led to anything but a few brief sparring matches, and until recent years, the celebration generally was held without incident. In the 1970s, however, it became common for men looking for a brawl to arrive in Rodanthe just before dark on Old Christmas. Frequently, the men were not from Hatteras Island, but from mainland communities or the northern reaches of the Outer Banks, and they started picking fights as soon as they got into town. The altercations ruined the holiday for some island residents. Even though Old Christmas has been held peacefully for the past several years, a few local families refused to attend. On January 4th, the day of the 1986 celebration, no one expected any violence. Several weeks before, family circumstances had made it necessary for me to move to Atlanta for most of the winter, but I had managed to return to Rodanthe for the weekend of Old Christmas. Late in the afternoon, I wandered down the gravel road to the community center, a small white building that once served as the town's single-room schoolhouse. The festivities were to have started at 1 p.m. with an oyster shoot, but it was nearly 2:30 when the first guns began to fire. On the far side of the patio, sheets of plywood had been fastened to a chain-link fence and painted with orange streaks to delineate the target zones. A knot of heads bent over a stack of paper targets that someone had spread on the hood of a car. Several of the targets were untouched. The marksman had missed them completely. One target had a hole only a quarter inch from the black bullseye. Maggie Smith, a thin woman with a strong chin and a ski cap covering a crop of dark hair, looked up from the targets and shrugged. "Looks like Joe Bob gets the oysters again," she said. It was the third time Joe Bob Fagundes, a local merchant, had won. The men standing around her grunted and moved off. Beside Smith was a 12-gauge shotgun and a box of shells. She is Mac Midget's sister, and she seemed at ease chatting with a half-dozen local men who stood on the fringe of the group. "Come on," she coaxed. "Who's next? $3 for a shot at a half bushel of Stumpy Point oysters, the best oysters around." I walked around the community center to where two men, both midgets, were stringing fishing net around a patio and stoking an oversized roaster with charcoal and wood. The roaster had been fashioned from a rusty oil drum, cut in half and hinged on one side. Long tables with rough plywood tops had been placed around it. As bushels of oysters finished roasting, the men would shovel them onto the tables for the crowd to shuck and eat. The coals would not be ready for a half hour, and I wandered inside. The tiny dance hall had begun to fill, and the instruments for a bluegrass band were set on stage. The dancing would come later. Now was the time for visiting. At the door, Luell Midget, an Ocracoke native who lives in Rodanthe with her husband, collected money and hugged friends as they entered. She saw many of them several times a month, but it was old Christmas, after all. I rounded a corner to the building's small kitchen and was enveloped by Virginia O'Neill, the postmistress, before I even saw her. "Merry old Christmas," she beamed, hugging me tighter. She wore a Christmas red skirt and jacket with a holly green pin on her lapel. Her face shone with a gracious, happy beauty. Around her were friends from the Fairhaven Methodist Church, older women named Midget, O'Neill, Hooper, and Gray, all in holiday clothes with festival smiles on their bright red lips. At a string of tables just off the kitchen, several women supervised a group of young children. These were the wives of the fishermen who congregated in a corner of the dance hall, smoking and leaning back, their crossed arms resting on ample bellies. I scanned the hall, finding scores of faces I did not recognize. It seemed many people had come from towns on the southern part of the Cape. I waved to Mac Midget and pushed my way toward the patio door. As I did, a stout woman with a wide face and large stylish glasses caught my arm. "Jan," I looked at her blankly. "I'm Joyce Rucker." Ursy Midget's only daughter. I pumped her hand and smiled. As a young girl, she had slept in the upstairs bedroom that I would later use as an office. At the age of 12, she had huddled inside the yellow frame house as a brutal wind wrenched it from its foundation. Standing behind her were her brothers, Stockton and Anderson, dressed nattily in plaid slacks. "I'm surprised to see you here," I said. It had not occurred to me that Ursie's children would attend old Christmas. "We wouldn't miss it for the world," Rucker said. "This is still home in some ways. But my, it's changed. Every year there are more strangers. There's no way to stop more people from coming here. The island's growing, and in many ways it's good that we have the kinds of amenities we have now. It was hard to live the way we did, with no electricity or roads. We have a movie theater in Avon now. I never thought I would live to see a movie theater open in Avon." A few minutes later, I left to get some oysters. Ursie's children were among the wealthiest and most controversial figures on Hatteras Island. They had made a substantial portion of their money by selling land. Tonight, they would rub elbows with fishermen who were slowly losing their livelihoods to pollution and powerful sport fishing lobbies. During the past 10 years, the people of Hatteras have divided themselves into two bitter camps, one that wants to preserve the Cape's rugged desolation, and a second that is working to build a string of glitzy resorts. Among the crowd in the community center were people who had grown up as cordial neighbors and who were now entangled in disputes over the boundaries of their land. The real estate speculators were winning the fight, or at least were making the most money and gaining the most political clout. But the development of Hatteras was not to be a topic of discussion. Not here. Not on Old Christmas. Outside, a batch of oysters had just finished cooking. A wiry man with curly brown hair opened the lid of the roaster. Steam cascaded into the night. "Who wants oysters?" he hollered. "You want oysters, you gotta make some noise." A few of us whooped. Pretty slack, he said, spreading the oysters across the table in front of me. I picked one up, twisted an oyster knife to pop open the gritty shell, and sucked down the tender flesh. I downed a dozen more and went inside, where the band had begun to play. The dance floor was filling with people of all ages and physiques, some twisting, some dancing a jerky version of the foxtrot. A fisherman with the build of a concrete block held up an arm to twirl his wife, who in her 40s still had the figure and toothy smile of a debutante. A thick-bodied elderly couple waltzed in the middle of the floor, bumping buttocks with the people around them. On the sidelines, women leaned their heads close together to talk above the music, and teenage girls shyly watched the dancers. I picked my way through to the other side and halted near Luell Midget, who was still standing guard at the door. "Interesting party, isn't it?" I said. "We usually have a good bit of fun," she said, smiling. "If I were you, I'd stand back against the wall a bit. Old Buck's getting ready to come in." Old Buck is a kind of Christmas Santa Claus, a mythical wild bull. It is said that many years ago, Old Buck impregnated every cow in Buxton Woods and terrorized local farmers until a hunter finally shot him. His spirit lives in the marshes and hammocks of Rodanthe. I had expected him to be personified by a mounted cow head, but the creature that stomped through the door had no eyes, nose, or mouth, just two horns and a piece of cowhide mounted on top of some long, sturdy object, probably a piece of wood. His lumpy back was covered by a green army blanket, beneath which protruded two sets of legs in blue jeans and men's boots. People crowded into the smoky hall, yelling and clapping, stomping their feet. A red-faced and jovial man led the cow into the room with a tether. "Look out! Old Buck's wild!" he yelled in a gravelly voice. "He's wild tonight!" I pressed myself against the wall as the four legs beneath the blanket kicked and clomped past me. Old Buck was not only wild, he was bent on knocking down as many people as he could. The crowd screamed with laughter and scrambled for cover, some people jumping into the laps of friends who had managed to find seats on the edge of the dance floor. As one man crouched down for a picture, the bull hit him broadside and sent him reeling across stage. 15 seconds later, Old Buck had jostled his way outside and vanished for another year. Seldom had I laughed so hard. The crowd caught its breath as the band swung into "Truck Driving Man" for the third time. The celebration had peaked. People drifted outside, calling goodbyes into the crisp night air. I had begun searching for my coat when the wiry man who had tended the oysters grabbed a microphone from the band. "Okay, I want all the children cleared out of here," he said, "because this is an adult's night, and us adults are gonna fight." "No, we're not," said a large fisherman standing next to me. I did not stay around to hear the shouting match that followed. Later, I learned that the man had been calmed by friends, and that violence had been avoided for another year. Barring hangovers, the town awoke the next day in good spirits. The only apparent casualty was a red pickup that had somehow missed the road and landed on its side in a muck-lined drainage ditch. We've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Yesteryear. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Joe Simpson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Following the broadcast, this episode is readily available as a podcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138.